Perhaps nothing better captures the fragility and wonder of the Jewish story than a small, slender Judean date palm that defied extinction. 2,000-year-old life from Masada that flourishes today in the soil of the Holy Land. Welcome to Bible 365, episode 56, Masada and the Miraculous Methuselah. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. High atop a mountain in the Judean desert sits Masada, one of the most famous archaeological sites in Israel. Crowds climb to its summit to commune with the warriors who once fought there, the warriors who died there. Masada, Hebrew for fortress, first came into being in the 30s BCE, when the paranoid but brilliant builder King Herod, fearing revolt, converted a clifftop garrison into fortifications fit for a king. A century later, when the Jewish rebellion began against Rome, a group of fierce Jewish fighters captured the fortress for themselves. When Jerusalem fell in 70 CE, the Jews on Masada remained, the last free Jews in Israel. They holed up within the fortress's walls, hoping against hope that help would arrive from Babylonian Jewry. They hoped in vain. Instead, in 73 CE, Rome's 10th Legion arrived at the foot of Masada. The Romans built an enormous ramp that can still be seen today and proceeded to conquer the fortress. And at the last moment, the Jewish fighters chose to die rather than to be captured by the Roman enemy. The story is famous, but much less known is a tree that is linked to that site. A tree that more than any other botanical specimen on earth best embodies one of the more mysterious biblical verses about trees, as well as the miraculous resurrection of the Jewish people. The subject of trees unexpectedly appears in Deuteronomy chapter 20. During a discussion of the laws of war. The chapter begins as follows. When thou goest forth to battle against thine enemies, and seize horses and chariots, and a people greater than thou, thou shalt not be afraid of them, for the Lord thy God is with thee, who brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. The Bible then goes on to describe the various warriors that are exempt from engaging in the war, and the obligation to allow a city of one's enemies to surrender. Verse 10. When thou drawest near unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. After this, in discussion of Israelites engaged in besieging a city, the Torah demands that fruit trees surrounding the site not be unnecessarily cut down. Verse 19, when thou shalt besiege a city a long time, in making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by wielding an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, for thou shalt not cut it down. The explanation that follows is ambiguous in the Hebrew. Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh, lavo aleha b'matzor. These words can be read in two ways. One is to see the sentence as a rhetorical question, translated this way. Is man like a tree in the field that comes before you in the siege? Meaning, a tree is nothing like a human being. You are fighting your enemies, not these trees. These trees didn't do anything to you. The trees are in no way comparable to the warriors you face, to the human beings against whom you are fighting. Read this way, a distinction is being made between trees and people. The other way to read it is the exact opposite, not as a rhetorical question, but as an affirmative statement. Fight your enemies, if you must, but not the fruit trees. Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh. Because trees are akin to human beings. Trees are in some way a symbol of innocent human beings, with the translation being, for man is like a tree in the field, meaning an innocent one in the field, that you happen to have come upon during the siege. So according to one interpretation, man is nothing like a tree in the field. According to the other, man is exactly like a tree in the field. Which is it? For Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, the unclear meaning of the verse hints to two interpretations that appear to oppose each other, but are actually both, in a sense, true. We saw in our very first Bible 365 episode how Rabbi Soloveitchik's archetypes of Adam 1 and Adam 2 relate to aspects of human nature that are within us, two features of our humanity that are at times in tension with one another, both teased out by Rabbi Soloveitchik from the first two chapters of Genesis. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about this in his great work, The Lonely Man of Faith. In an essay published some years after, titled Majesty and Humility, he describes a similar dialectic within us. And he uses the exegetical ambiguity of our verse about men and trees in order to do so. Rabbi Soloveitchik describes two aspects of ourselves. One is what he calls cosmic. This reflects our urge to explore all of existence. In this respect, man is nothing like a tree, for this is an aspect of human nature that defies rootedness, that seeks to move, to travel, to go where no one has gone before. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote this essay, like the Lonely Man of Faith, during the Apollo space missions. And this is clear when he describes the cosmic, majestic element within human nature. Quote, "Man is cosmic through his experiential involvement. Man is cosmos-oriented, not only intellectually, but emotionally as well. He loves the cosmos. He, in person, wants to be everywhere. Man is questing, not only to know the universe, but also to experience it. Explorer and adventurer, he feels bored by the monotony and the routine of familiar surroundings. He is out to see the world. Man is not satisfied sending up unmanned vehicles to gather scientific data. He is eager to do it himself. He wishes to move with the velocity of light into a world of the unknown." End quote. And then, citing the Hebrew from Deuteronomy, from our verse, he adds that this allows us to offer one interpretation of the two that we discussed. Quote, "Ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor," contains a rhetorical question. Is man like the tree of the field? Is the tree as mobile as man? Certainly not. Man's greatness and distinctiveness find expression in his ceaseless mobility. The tree is inseparable from the soil. Man can and does move away from home, end quote. So Rabbi Soloveitchik puts it. But to this he adds another aspect of our humanity. Much as human beings may explore, they also simultaneously feel drawn to one's origins, to one's family, to one's story. The truth is that a human being can be compared to a tree, and Deuteronomy can be understood as seeing a genuine parallel between a fruit tree in a field and a human being. For just like a tree, we have roots. We have origins which exert an influence on us, which fuel us, which inspire us. Again, citing our ambiguous verse and, unusually, quoting British literature, here is what Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, quote, "The home for which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back, no matter how far he has traveled. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill." These beautiful lines by Robert Louis Stevenson contain more than a nostalgic note. And then Rabbi Soloveitchik adds, "The man is indeed like the tree in the field." In this context, the verse should be interpreted as an affirmative statement, not a rhetorical question. Man is indeed a rooted being, attached and committed to a homestead, no matter how far he may have traveled, end quote. In our opening Bible 365 talk, we described how the story of Apollo 13 parallels the dialectic of Adam 1 and Adam 2. It is striking, therefore, that just around the time that Rabbi Soloveitchik published this essay, Majesty and Humility, another astronaut that we have mentioned in our discussions, Gene Cernan, stood on the moon and watched the Earth rise. Cernan would be known as the last man to have strolled the lunar surface because no missions followed his. Suddenly, before boarding, before journeying back to Earth, he paused, bent over, and etched the letters TDC in the moon dust at his feet. These are the initials of his daughter, Tracy Dawn Cernan. And because of the weather on the moon, the initials will be there, as Cernan put it, forever, however long that is. It's a striking story. An astronaut engaged in a human triumph achieved by few others pauses at the last moment not to celebrate himself, but to emphasize his connectedness to another. Cernan, interestingly, reflected later in an interview that, quote, "I had no plans to do that. It just seemed like the thing to do at the time." And he added, "I just did it and I can't tell you why." Gene Cernan remembering his daughter while looking at Earth from the moon is a reminder that even the most extraordinary cosmic achievements cannot compensate for the other side of ourselves, the rootedness that we have. Neil Armstrong in landing on the moon gave voice to the uprooted exploration through which mankind in one small step can achieve. But the three letters lovingly and eternally etched on the lunar surface may tell us more about our humanity than Neil Armstrong's footprint ever did. Rabbi Soloveitchik's reflections, both in The Lonely Man of Faith and in Majesty and Humility, speak profoundly to the biblical text surrounding our verse in Deuteronomy. 4. We have seen, on the one hand, how Deuteronomy commands us to wholeheartedly, faithfully focus on God, to love Him in the words of the Shema, with all our hearts, with all our souls, with all our might. And yet throughout these chapters that we are studying, the Bible describes Israelites engaging the larger world, the realms of agriculture, economy, and polity. In our verses and in others, Deuteronomy describes the obligations of one who is at war. There are obligations regarding fields tithing and the sabbatical year. We read of kings and of courts. This all instructs us that the Israelite is meant to be devoted to the divine and also engage in the world. Citing verses from Deuteronomy, Rabbi Soloveitchik describes how striking this is. He writes, quote, "On the one hand, the Bible commands man, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might, a performance of which only covenantal man is capable, since he alone possesses the talent for complete concentration upon and immersion in the focus without being distracted by peripheral interests, anxieties, and problems. On the other hand, the same Bible, which just enjoined man to withdraw from the periphery to the center, commands him to return to the majestic community, which, preoccupied with peripheral interests, anxieties, and problems, builds, plants, harvests, regulates rivers, heals the sick, participates in state affairs, is imaginative in dreaming, bold in planning, daring in undertaking," end quote. And Rabbi Soloveitchik adds, "The Bible speaks of an existence this worldly centered, when thou buildest a new home, when thou cuttest down thine harvest, when thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, yet theo-oriented and unqualifiedly committed to an eternal purpose," end quote. So he writes, how can both be achieved? How can the realm of religious devotion demanded by Deuteronomy and the realm of human achievement described by Deuteronomy become one? For by Soloveitchik, the two are joined through the Torah, where mitzvot, commandments, allow us to sanctify every aspect of human existence. So Deuteronomy, in other words, is telling us, by all means engage in business, but follow the ethical codes of the commandments, build a polity and defend it, but heed the spiritual and political wisdom of the Torah. Plant fields, sow and reap crops, seek success through the harvest, but tithe that which heaven bestows upon you. Observe the sabbatical laws, and ensure that you come to Jerusalem 3 times a year to rediscover your roots and ensure thereby that as a people, even exile will ultimately not undo the profound rootedness of the Jewish people to Jerusalem and the God who makes his home in Jerusalem. Rabbi Soloveitchik, describing the halakha, Jewish law, in his own words, writes as follows, quote, "To use a metaphor, I would say that the norm in the opinion of the halakha is the tentacle by which the covenant, like the ivy, attaches itself and spreads over the world of majesty," end quote. And so man is both unlike a tree and like a tree, engaged in extraordinary achievement and breakthroughs, and yet still rooted. And both meanings of our verse can in turn be seen from one of the lesser known miracles of modern Israel. In the 1960s, Yigal Yadin excavated Masada. The archaeologists uncovered a store of date pits from dates that had been stockpiled by the besieged Jewish defenders. The seeds lay dormant in a drawer for decades. But, interestingly, they came from a species that was no longer in existence. The Judean date palm, once the most famous and flourishing source of produce in Israel. Thus, Roman Emperor Vespasian minted silver coins that circulated throughout the empire, depicting a weeping Jewish captive sitting under a date palm with a proclamation Judea Capta, meaning Judea, land of the date palms, is captured, desolated, destroyed. Sometime after the Roman conquest, the Judean date palm disappeared. The palms that one sees all over Israel today are not from the original ones that were native to the Holy Land during the Second Temple period. 40 years after Masada's excavation, an Israeli botanist, Elaine Soloway, took one of the date pits and had it treated in a solution, and then it was planted. Soon news sites were able to report headlines such as, quote, "Palm resurrected from a 2,000-year-old seed," end quote. Today, this tree, known as Methuselah, in a certain sense the oldest tree in Israel, grows in the Judean desert, the first Judean date palm in 2,000 years, a striking symbol of the resurrection and resilience of the Jewish people. Can there be, ladies and gentlemen, a better embodiment of both meanings of our tree verse, of majestic scientific achievement and Israelite roots, than the science of modern Israel being used to not only achieve a remarkable botanical breakthrough, but also to highlight the rootedness of the Jewish people in the sacred soil of the Holy Land? As I noted in my Case for God series, the Romans could scarcely have imagined that the siege tower they created at Masada would one day be used as a path for Jewish tourists, and that the fortress they conquered would one day be used to swear on Israeli troops, promising, as they did so, that Masada will not fall again. But I added that perhaps nothing better captures the fragility and wonder of the Jewish story more than a small, slender Judean date palm that defied extinction. 2,000-year-old life from Masada that flourishes today in the soil of the Holy Land, even as the glory of all that was Vespasian's Roman Empire is now an archaeological curiosity. When you go to war, preserve a tree, so Deuteronomy said. Now, centuries after a devastating war, the Judean tree stands preserved. No other nation has a story of miraculous resurrection like the Jews. And one tiny tree from Masada serves as a testament to the roots of a miraculous people and to the wonder of Jewish eternity. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.